promoting scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captain of a scientific technological elite.
We've signed a climate convention on the importance of economic instruments and free markets. We're included in this mammoth Agenda 21 document and the Rio Declaration. Now, let me be clear on one fundamental point. The United States fully intends to be the world's preeminent leader in protecting the global environment.
Coming up, Technocracy News. Welcome to Technocracy News. Patrick Wood here, editor-in-chief and founder of Technocracy News and Trends. Today, we're going to take a look at Google starting out. And the headline of this story is Antitrust Probe Led by Texas. 50 state AGs are piling on Google, finally. I commented at the top of this article, shields up. Technocrats at Google have finally raised the alarm with the legal political system who are finally waking up to the threat of technocracy. Now, of course, they don't know it's called technocracy yet, but as you may know from having read my book, Technocracy, The Hard Road to World Order, or Technocracy Rising, The Trojan Horse of Globalization, then you will know that politicians and the rule of law are the mortal enemies of technocracy in general. They don't want anything to do with it. Technocrats want to run everything by themselves, without any interference from those pesky old elected by citizens representatives of the people. This article starts out, 50 attorneys general are joining the investigation into Google over possible antitrust violations. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, the initiative's leader, announced Monday. The news confirms reports last week about the bipartisan investigation into Google's practices. The probe includes attorneys general from 48 states, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico. California and Alabama are not involved in the probe, Paxton said in a press release. And, of course, you might figure that California wouldn't be involved. That's where Google is located. Other attorneys general in the media conference emphasize Google's dominance in the ad market and the use of consumer data. Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody said, quote, "When there is no longer a free market or competition, this increases prices, even when something is marketed as free and harms consumers. Is something really free if we are increasingly giving over our privacy information? Is something really free if online ad prices go up based on one company's control?" An antitrust probe into Facebook was announced on Friday by the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, who will lead the case. Attorneys general from 7 states plus the District of Columbia are participating in the Facebook investigation. At the press conference Monday, D.C. Attorney General Carl Racine, a Democrat, said, quote, "It remains to be seen if two probes will be a coordinated expansion." When reached for comment, a Google spokesman pointed to a company blog post published Friday where it acknowledged it had received requests for information from the Department of Justice about its business practices and expects state attorneys general will ask similar questions. "We have always worked constructively with regulators, and we will continue to do so," Google said in Friday's post. The state investigations put an additional layer of pressure on both companies, which are already facing antitrust scrutiny on the federal level. Facebook confirmed an antitrust probe by the Federal Trade Commission in July, after the agency slapped it with a $5 billion fine over its privacy practices, and the Department of Justice will conduct its own antitrust investigation into Google, according to the Wall Street Journal. The attorneys general involved in the Google probe said their investigation would remain independent from those of other areas of government. "The state attorneys general, they are an independent bunch," Racine said, "and they can be quite tenacious. So I'm very confident that this bipartisan group is going to be led by the facts and not be swayed by any conclusion that may fall short, if you will, if it's inconsistent with our facts on the federal side. So we're going to do what we think is right based on our investigation." Now, this is very significant for this reason. When you have 50 state attorneys general at the same time ganging up together to pile on a single company. You have more than just an incidental probe that you need to cooperate with. This is an attack on Google. Google is going to fight back with everything they have to keep out from under this investigation, and they will use everything in their power to deflect this investigation into oblivion. Technocrats hate government. This was the case in the 1930s, and it's been the case ever since. Technocrats simply want to run everything according to their scientific method, and big tech is a perfect example of that. Google has never been concerned with local, state, or federal law in moderating their own behavior. They simply have done what they wanted to do and what they felt best about. So now that the combined weight of the government is coming after them, even though they're using the antitrust concept to do it, Google is in big trouble. Google is now facing the combined weight of the government. And of course, Google is a big enough company where they can bear up under that in one sense. They have as much money as the government does to fight this, probably. But I think the mother of all battles has just been unleashed. And it'll be interesting to see how it turns out. Google has every reason to sweat at this point, and the people have every reason to get behind their state attorney general in this probe. The next story is a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek in a way. I called the title of this Hot Air: Is Extreme Journalism Causing Global Warming? Now, of course, that's a rhetorical question, and no, extreme journalism itself cannot cause global warming. But given the amount of hot air that many of these extreme journalists have, you wonder if they would just shut their mouth if there would be a cooling of the Earth's atmosphere. I noted on this article, if you want to fight climate change, tell extremist journalists to stifle their constant flow of hot air. The rhetoric in this story is spun out of thin air and pure conjecture, and it is presented as if it will most certainly become reality. Well, it won't. And here's what the journalist said. This appeared on Vox, by the way, a well-known blog, been around for a long time, left-leaning. The journalist wrote, "To live in the 21st century is to live with the threat of weather growing more and more wicked. Droughts, heat waves, and wildfires are growing more intense and dangerous from global warming and rising greenhouse gas emissions. Meanwhile, we're not reckoning with scientists' predictions that worst-case weather scenarios will be more likely and common if we don't change course. Only 41% of the American public believes climate change will affect them personally, a 2018 survey by Yale and George Mason University found. Phoenix, Arizona is susceptible to a heat wave that could peak at a staggering 122 degrees Fahrenheit. Southern California could face a wildfire that burns 1.5 million acres of land. Tampa, Florida could see 26 feet of storm surge flooding from a hurricane, just below the record-breaking 28-foot storm surge of Hurricane Katrina. In every case, these, quote, big ones could be huge disasters, not just because of geography and proximity to threats, but also because of decisions to build homes and offices in certain places, ignoring nature. Many other communities in the same regions have similar vulnerabilities. For too long, we've been complacent about climate change and the really scary possibilities of 2 degrees Celsius, that's 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, he notes, or more of average warming. 2 degrees is the amount of warming we are likely to experience by mid-century and is double the warming we've experienced to date. As David Wallace Wells, author of The Uninhabitable Earth, put it in a Vox interview, being scared about what is possible in the future can be motivating. Let me just make a comment about that. Being scared about what is possible in the future can be motivating. Number one, we don't know the future. Number two, why would we be motivated by fear about the future that we know nothing about yet? Well, the answer is obvious. People are not motivated about what might be possible in the future when there's no clear evidence that it's going to happen. The article continues, Californians have long been taught to fear and prepare for the next big earthquake, and the state now has stronger infrastructure and wide engagement in earthquake readiness and planning. If more communities around the country feared climate big ones, they and their leaders would be more engaged in both stopping fossil fuel use and readying for disaster. The scenarios in Phoenix, Southern California, and Tampa we describe in this three-part series are hypothetical, but they're based on models scientists use to project what's possible today or tomorrow. There's always uncertainty in these models. Yes, there is, I might add. Things can change. These aren't premonitions, but tastes of what's possible. We face more and more expensive disasters, and we are still building right in the paths of tempests. But our ability today to anticipate dangerous future weather creates an opportunity to reconcile with where we let people build, how we manage vegetation that could burn, and whether we replace more trees and soil with heat-magnifying concrete. For a look what's in store, let's begin in Arizona. Now he tells a story. One day in the future, a massive wave of high-pressure air will park over Phoenix. As the sun rises amid an already scorching summer, the pressure will hold the accumulated heat in place, and the triple-digit temperatures will tick up higher and higher, 119 degrees Fahrenheit, 120, 121, 122. Health officials will warn citizens to stay inside, but some will venture out and emergency room visits will spike. At night, the temperature will drop only to 100 degrees. It's an alarming prospect for a rising population. Phoenix is home to 1.6 million people and is the second fastest growing city in the United States. The metro area is home to 4 million and is projected to grow to 6.6 million by 2050. By then, more than 20% of the population will be older than 65. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that heat is already the deadliest weather phenomenon in the U.S., killing hundreds of people a year, more than floods, fires, earthquakes, lightning strikes, tornadoes, or hurricanes. With climate change, the threat is only getting worse, particularly for the elderly and the impoverished. Over the next 24 hours of this heat wave, electricity use will surge as millions of air conditioners blast at full force, and the power grid will sputter as power lines strain. Power plants will run dangerously low on cooling water as the rivers that feed the region slow to a trickle and heat up. Generators will become less efficient. The grid will succumb to brownouts and blackouts. Air conditioners will wheeze out, leaving many in homes that will grow dangerously hot. Water pumps will shut off, threatening people with dehydration. Freezers will thaw and food will spoil. Lines will form at gas stations as stalled pumps force drivers to refuel by hand. Anxiety will grow about the region's water supply. Phoenix metropolitan region will already be in a drought, and what little water is left will start becoming too hot to use. The nearby water reservoirs will be at record lows. Golf courses turn yellow as water restrictions go into effect. By day five, city officials will declare a public health emergency. Officials will ask people to congregate in malls, libraries, and rec centers to minimize the cooling load. So there you have it, my friends. Phoenix has just been destroyed by a massive heat wave that will drive people out of their homes and into the malls and libraries and rec centers around the city to minimize the cooling load and to prevent mass die-off of people because of the heat. The only hot air here and the only heat is in the intensity of this article to spin a completely off-the-wall scenario that would better be made into a science fiction movie that would probably do very well, by the way, in Hollywood, along with the other disaster movies that are always attempting to save the world from some major disaster or attacking force or space aliens or whatever. But this scenario is absolutely off the wall. So again, as I said, if you want to fight climate change, tell extremist journalists like this to stifle their constant flow of hot air. The rhetoric in this story is simply spun out of thin air and pure conjecture, and yet it will be tweeted and posted and reposted all over the internet as if it were the gospel truth, and people will believe it as true. Oh my gosh, have you heard about Phoenix? Phoenix is going to have an absolute disaster, or they are having an absolute disaster as temperatures rise above 110 degrees or whatever. Well, as a matter of fact, the hottest day in Phoenix, Arizona was 122 degrees back in the late 1980s, and it got so warm that the planes had to be grounded at Sky Harbor Airport. Why? Because the tarmac was too hot for the planes to roll down the runway, and they were leaving big ruts in the asphalt. So they simply shut down the airport for a couple of days. Temperature went down. The tarmac cooled off enough to where planes could take off again, and all was good. And Phoenix did not cease to exist. Yes, there are problems, but problems exist for people to solve them, and they've all been solved just fine. So no, Mr. Journalist, because you present a very, very scary story about how Phoenix, Arizona is going to suffer, sweat, and potentially just expire, we are not motivated to any particular action about something that you cannot demonstrate scientifically is ever, ever, ever going to happen. So, enough for hot air. The next story is very serious, and it's also very surprising. It has to do with NPR. That's National Public Radio, NPR.org. They recently posted an article that exposes the CIA's MKUltra program of mind control and torture experiments that happened back during the Cold War, that is during the 1950s and early 1960s. This was a horrific program, and it's amazing that NPR would print anything on what is now known as the CIA's infamous and horrific MKUltra program. Repatriated technocrat scientists, by the way, from Nazi Germany, played a key role in this after World War II. They came back to America from Nazi Germany after the war, instead of being sent to Nuremberg trials where they should have been convicted of crimes. They were brought back under a very top-secret program at the time called Operation Paperclip. Their histories were scoured and scrubbed, sanitized, if you will, and they were placed into positions of scientific inquiry within universities, within NASA, within the military. And some of this thinking obviously infiltrated the CIA as it opened up a program called MKUltra. People who have dared talk about MKUltra over the years have been branded as conspiracy theorists, nutcakes, tinfoil hat-wearing weirdos. But now how are you going to apply that label to NPR, which is a bastion of leftism in America, by the way? This article states, during the early period of the Cold War, the CIA became convinced that communists had discovered a drug or technique that would allow them to control human minds. In response, the CIA began its own secret program, which was called MKUltra, to search for a mind-control drug that could be weaponized against enemies. MKUltra, which operated from the 1950s until the early 1960s, was created and run by a chemist named Sidney Gottlieb. Journalist Stephen Kinzer, who spent several years investigating the program, calls the operation the, quote, most sustained search in history for techniques of mind control. Some of Gottlieb's experiments were covertly funded at universities and research centers, Kinzer says, while others were conducted in American prisons and detention centers in Japan, Germany, and the Philippines. Many of his unwitting subjects endured psychological torture ranging from electroshock to high doses of LSD, according to Kinzer's research. Gottlieb wanted to create a way to seize control of people's minds, and he realized it was a two-part process, Kinzer says. First, you had to blast away the existing mind. Second, you had to find a way to insert a new mind into that resulting void. We didn't get too far on number two, but he did a lot of work on number one. Kinzer notes that the top-secret nature of Gottlieb's work makes it impossible to measure the human cost of his experiments. We don't know how many people died, but a number did, and many lives were permanently destroyed, he says. Ultimately, Gottlieb concluded that mind control was not possible. After MKUltra shut down, he went on to lead a CIA program that created poisons and high-tech gadgets for spies to use. Kinzer writes about Gottlieb and MKUltra in his new book, Poisoner in Chief. That's poisoner as in poison. Poisoner in Chief. And the book review that follows is very telling on how the CIA brought LSD to America. You heard that right. It was the CIA, on the basis of MKUltra, that introduced America to the psychedelic drug LSD. The book review states, as part of the research for drugs that would allow people to control the human mind, CIA scientists became aware of the existence of LSD, and this became an obsession for the early directors of MKUltra. Actually, the MKUltra director, Sidney Gottlieb, can now be seen as the man who brought LSD to America. He was the unwitting godfather of the entire LSD counterculture. In the early 1950s, he arranged for the CIA to pay $240,000 to buy the world's entire supply of LSD, the entire stock of LSD in the world. He brought this to the United States, and he began spreading it around to hospitals, clinics, prisons, and other institutions, asking them, through bogus foundations, to carry out research projects and find out what LSD was, how people reacted to it, and how it might be able to be used as a tool for mind control. Now, the people who volunteered for these experiments began taking LSD, in many cases found it very pleasurable. They told their friends about it. Who were these people? Well, Ken Kesey, the author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, got his LSD in an experiment sponsored by the CIA, by MKUltra, by Sidney Gottlieb. So did Robert Hunter, the lyricist for The Grateful Dead, which went on to become a great purveyor of LSD culture. Allen Ginsberg, the poet who preached the value of great personal adventure of using LSD, got his first LSD from Sidney Gottlieb, although, of course, he never knew that name. So the CIA brought LSD to America unwittingly, and actually it's a tremendous irony that the drug that the CIA hoped would be the key to controlling humanity actually wound up fueling a generational rebellion that was dedicated to destroying everything that the CIA would hold dear and defend. Whitney Bulger was one of the prisoners who volunteered of what he was told was an experiment aimed at finding a cure for schizophrenia. As part of this experiment, he was given LSD every day for more than a year. He later realized that this had nothing to do with schizophrenia, and he was a guinea pig in a government experiment aimed at seeing what people's long-term reactions to LSD was. Essentially, could we make a person lose his mind by feeding him LSD every day over such a long period? Well, this story goes on. I can recommend that you read it in total because it's a very disturbing story, and it is surprising that NPR finally is willing to talk about this. And by the way, they sat by idly during those days of old and said nothing. People actually died during the MKUltra experiments. Sidney Gottlieb skated, got no penalty whatsoever, and went on to serve the CIA in other disturbing areas. It should be clear, even by this story, that the CIA has been rogue for many, many years. And this is disturbing. I would encourage every listener of this program today to go to the Corbett Report, which is located at CorbettReport.com, since this is, in fact, 9/11 of 2019. James Corbett has just published several interviews with 9/11 whistleblowers. That is, people who are considered whistleblowers. Most of them lost their jobs, had their careers destroyed because they dared to tell some alternative truth to the official story that was released on 9/11. The official story of 9/11, by the way, is so riddled with errors, with corruption, with deception, that even the fire marshals from all around the Northeast are demanding another investigation into 9/11. That's right. The fire marshals of multiple cities are demanding a new investigation into 9/11 and what really happened. And I would encourage you to listen to the videos that James Corbett has posted. Most of them contain footage of actual interviews and with these whistleblowers. You'll find it fascinating. And what's fascinating is, and what's most fascinating about this, is that there's a high likelihood that the CIA was somehow involved with 9/11. There's also another train of thought with CIA involvement in the JFK assassination. And there's been some tremendous work produced on that that shoot holes in the official investigation of JFK's death. We wonder about what the deep state is in America. And it's hard to describe. It's hard to define. But we know somehow that the CIA is very much a part of the deep state. And you have to wonder, with all of the horrible things that the CIA has done over the years, why it has not been disbanded outright and just dissolved. Send everybody home, goodbye, and don't come back. It's not that this is impossible, of course, because Congress controls the budget. And Congress can control any part of the agencies that sit under the administration's umbrella, and yet they have never, ever chosen to lay a finger on the CIA. I think it's time for a top-down investigation on the CIA in general to expose all of the things that they have been involved in over the years that have harmed America, American citizens, American reputation, and have acted completely outside of the rule of law and outside of any accountability and responsibility. I'm Patrick Wood for Technocracy News and Trends. We'll see you next time.